Scott Muskin holds a MFA from the University of Minnesota and a BA from Grinnell College. His first novel, published by Hooded Friar Press, is called The Annunciations of Hank Meyerson, Mama's Boy and Scholar. He won the Parthenon Prize for Fiction for the manuscript of The Annunciations of Hank Meyerson. And Scott is joining us on Real Good Words now from Minneapolis. Scott, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about this Parthenon Prize for Fiction, because that's an award before you were published.
That's correct. It was for unpublished manuscripts.
Tell us more about that. How did you find that, and how did it help you?
You know, I honestly can't remember how I found it. They did a really good job of publicizing the prize to AWP, Associated Writing Programs, and actually contacting the writing programs themselves. So I probably heard about it through the U of M's alumni email, announcement about a prize, and it was $8,000, which is eye-catching, you know, anytime talking about any kind of prize. And I had just gotten the book into what I thought would be its final form, although I had thought that before. And so I thought, well, what the heck, I'll just send it. And then in August, I got a call saying that I had been selected as the winner, and I barely even remembered sending the prize in, which is sort of a self-preservative technique for when you get the rejection letter. But I got the call that I had won, and it's really changed everything. It was wonderful. They're very wonderful people running the prize. They employed 50 volunteer readers from the Nashville area. They're based out of Nashville. And these 50 readers read four or five manuscripts each and gave sort of detailed thoughts on them, and then it was this sort of bubbling up process. So it was a pretty cool contest to win, because it didn't really come from the literary establishment. It came from just regular people wanting to support really good writing.
This may be too personal, but do you use the $8,000 then to just support your lifestyle as a writer, or did you use it for something particular?
No, I didn't use it. I just threw it into the general fund. it was a wonderful prize. They didn't really set it up in the best of ways, so I had to pay taxes on it and all that stuff, which
okay.
I was more than fine with. It supported a couple of months of not having to work while preparing for my wife giving birth to our baby, which happened in 2008, and also just time to edit the book, to do a sort of substantial edit once I came to agreement with the Hooded Friar Press. So that was very helpful, to not have to worry about, you know, working when you're spending time trying to make the book as good as possible. That was extremely helpful.
That's Scott Muskin. We are talking about his novel. It's called The Annunciations of Hank Meyerson, Mama's Boy and Scholar. So who is this guy, Hank Meyerson?
Well, he's the guy who was never okay with where he ended up in life. And was always wishing, gosh, I should be this, and I could be that. And to some degree, that's all of us. But he has it really bad. And he is fumbling around with that, and one of his fumbles ends up being something he didn't really bargain for, and it sort of sets the whole path of the novel, the whole plot of the novel, I should say. And he's this lovable guy who's shaggy, rough around the edges, he curses too much, he cries too much. He's kind of a jerk, you know. You know, he's not the most likable character in contemporary fiction, that's for sure. But there's something endearing about him. I think people end up rooting for him.
I love that he's a chubby guy. And, you know, usually the main character of a book, especially if it's a male, I know this is a very small point, but they're not usually chubby. They're usually a little more perfect. And I think that's one of the reasons I was drawn to Hank.
Yeah, I don't think it's a small point at all. I think that this is always something that's confounded me about characters. It's in fiction, we sort of have this love-hate relationship. We want these characters to be identifiable and real and relevant to our lives, but we also want them to be somebody we want to, you know, read about, that we have an attraction to, sort of. So I took it as a challenge to myself. Well, how am I going to create a character that's attractive, but attractive in ways that are more true to life and more like somebody, a compelling friend that you had, and less attractive for their astounding physical abilities and astounding, and also because it honestly it set up the yin and yang with his brother Carlton, and that's a huge part of the book. Carlton's the good-looking, athletic one, and Sim.
Tell us more about the two brothers and their relationship.
Yeah, it's this sort of the scene where in the book where the brothers, it's a flashback, and they're within about a year and a half of each other, and their parents belong to this country club, and they play tennis at the country club, and Hank's never beaten his brother, and they play tennis, and Hank, they're going to play, and they're sort of bonding, you know, brotherly, but Hank knows that usually after the brotherly bonding, Carlton usually goes out and whips him, and Carlton gets stung on the tongue by a wasp, and still insists on playing, and something about this sort of infuriates Hank, and he ends up beating him for the first time, and then it triggers this base brotherly violence in Carlton that just sums up their relationship. It's this Hank, the younger brother, sort of simultaneously idolizing and, you know, hating his brother for his success and his grace and his abilities. And Carlton plays the part perfectly as the brother who takes it upon himself to upbraid Hank and chastise him and make him feel low, but does it in sort of like with the best of intentions, but in that sort of brotherly way that no one else can really get away with. The sort of close enough to punch, sort of. They keep each other close enough to punch.
So what's it like for you in terms of names? Did Hank Meyerson, do you remember how it came to you or why you knew it was right?
No, I guess why Meyerson is a family name. It's my dad's mother's maiden name is Meyerson. My dad's grandmother, Lena Meyerson, was kind of a matriarch of our family. She was this incredible woman. And I just wanted somehow to have that name. It's identifiably Jewish to me. And the name Hank, before it, fits perfectly with Hank's character from my point of view and was very generative writing because it's a little rougher, it's not polished, and it's also not Jewish. And that sums up Hank. Hank and his brother converted when they were very young children when their mother married, sort of remarried, their biological father having sort of taken off. She remarries into Judaism. So they're Jewish, but not Jewish. You know, they're converted Jewish, and they're blonde. And I thought this name, Hank Meyerson, was just evocative of all those things.
And being Jewish is part of their relationship or kind of their... Tell us more about that. Do you know what I mean? Between the brothers, between Carlton and Hank?
Yeah. For Hank, he's very much a secular Jewish guy. It's not part of his theological thinkings at all. In fact, he doesn't really think theologically until later in the book, sort of. It's not really part of him. It's a cultural part of him. And he and Carlton, like a lot of secular Jews, use that cultural part to wrangle with one another, but also to sort of bond and identify and sort of reaffirm their connections to one another and their identity just in general. And I think a lot of secular Jews do this. Just because they're secular doesn't mean that they're secularized and don't really think about God or theology in any significant sense. They still use this cultural side as an identifier, as a mark of who you are. And they do that between one another very much. And often it's used as sort of bludgeoning device against one another as well. Carlton has much more of a deeper perspective on it, and it sort of is the thing that gets him in trouble and roils him as the book unfolds.
We're talking about Scott Muskin's novel. It's called The Annunciations of Hank Meyerson, Mama's Boy and Scholar. So tell us about Hank and the women in his life, the relationships he has with his wife and his sister-in-law.
We got a nice review in the Star Tribune, and the reviewer was Emily Carter. And one of the things I really liked about what she said, she said that the book portrays women as best as the first time male novelists can do, which is not perfect, but close, really close, she said. But another thing she said was that Hank is sort of attractive in ways to women in the ways that in real life just doesn't happen. You know, he's schlubby and he's, you know, overweight, as we were talking about earlier. But he's compelling, and I think he's one of these guys that once he's established an intimacy with you, that intimacy is compelling. And the two main women in his life, well, his mom, who's dead, died in a car accident when he was in college, but she's an ever-present figure in the book. But then there's Carol Ann and June, and Carol Ann and Hank are married, and it's a fraught marriage, to say the least. They were one of these college relationships that ended up just sort of by the force of their own inertia, if that makes any sense, ended up in marriage. And at the beginning of the book, we learn that Carol Ann's had an affair, and Hank sort of reeling from this. And Carol Ann's one of these dominant personalities. She's like the force to be reckoned with in any room. And then the other person in Hank's life who becomes very close to is Carlton's wife, June. And June is sort of crass. She's pretty, but not terribly feminine. You know, they drink beer on the porch and talk about Hank's troubles. You know, that's how they're intimate. They tell each other their troubles. And this is the crux of the book. Hank ends up falling in love with June, and how that unfolds is basically the driving force between the book, that and the brother relationship. Mm-hmm. And you can see where that goes, I'm sure.
Well, it's such an interesting relationship for you to explore, because, you know, in some ways it's okay to be intimate with your brother or sister-in-law, but there's still lines to be drawn in those relationships, and you're not actually related, you know, and I thought that was a really interesting part of this story.
I appreciate that. I appreciate what you just said, because I think that is one of the sort of the lines or taboos that the book skitters around. I wanted the book to have basically four or five characters. They're all related in some way, and they're all intimate with one another, and just let that be stuff from which those relationships be the stuff from which the book rises, you know, like bread. And the idea that you would fall in love with your sister-in-law is sort of like a huge cliche in some ways, but it just seemed to come organically out of the writing I was doing in early drafts, and I became very enamored with it early on, and it had its own attraction.
Tell us about what the writing process is like for you. I know you also, as most writers do, have to work at other jobs, and are there...
I do.
How do you fit it in? Is there a place where you write better, or do you set up a schedule?
Yeah, schedules have never been my strong point. It's important to mentally conceive of yourself as a writer, because no one else is going to do that for you, for sure. There's plenty of people giving you plenty of reasons why you shouldn't do it. So that's kind of the primary thing. But because otherwise, all of your other tasks in life and your responsibilities in life will overwhelm your writing. And so anybody who ever asks for advice, like young writers, I always tell them that's the first and foremost thing. I find it important to have a physical space. I've always tried to have either a small office where I could go and just plop down and start, pick back up with wherever I was before, and I don't have to worry about anybody else moving stuff around or keeping up appearances for anything or anything at all. So that's important. A schedule was definitely important while I was writing this book, because I was working a full-time job, so I'd get up early in the morning and write before going to the full-time job, and sometimes would do some more in the evening. But I'm a firm believer, too, that you have to have a life, because you need stuff to sort of regenerate your creative self. You need a, quote, real life, end quote, to regenerate your creative self. That's very, very important.
When I was reading about you and your bio, and that your background is in copywriting and working in advertising and marketing, I wondered if that helps you in terms of writing fiction, because every single word is important when you're not writing that many words about something, or do you know what I mean, in your field?
Yes. Yeah, definitely I know what you mean. It has helped. I first came out of the literary publishing and MFA, you know, world, where everything you did was precious, very precious. You're working on precious things and very important, thoughtful things. Then when you get into the more commercial side of things, you learn very quickly that not much of what you write is precious at all. So one way it helped, for sure, is that I became someone who could take enormous criticisms and reorient them back into making for a better end product. And still trying to stay true to my original vision and not let that be compromised, but recognizing that some degree of collaboration is good, no question about that, which you learn in advertising. And also you learn that you're lucky if anyone reads anything that you've ever written, that you write. Especially I do a lot of interactive writing for the web, and there's several times where I'm working on a project and I'll just say, strong odds that no one's ever going to read this body of text on this page, you know, buried in a website somewhere. It doesn't mean it doesn't need to be good, but it sort of puts it in perspective for you. So a little bit of that has, bringing that perspective a little bit to my creative writing, my fiction, has I think made me a better writer, no question about it.
Also, you have in your acknowledgments, you're mentioning some places that you went, art colonies or retreats or that kind of thing. Can you tell us more about that? I always find those things very interesting.
Yeah, I could have easily just said in the acknowledgments, I would like to thank heaven for allowing me to stay in its various locales on Earth. I found those experiences to be enormously rewarding and generative and just exactly what I needed. Some people find them difficult. So essentially what you're there, you go to a place and sometimes there are mentors there that you specifically go to work with, and sometimes it's just you're just there to do your own work. And they give you varying degrees of space, workspace, room and board, you know, food and a place to live. And just the idea is to be removed from your everyday life so you can focus. I found it just absolutely wonderful. When I first got to the Millay Colony for the Arts in upstate New York, she was showing me around my space. It's located on Edna St. Vincent Millay's farm, or what used to be her farm. And we were in her barn, and I had the studio space in part of the barn, and I just started crying. I was like, all this is mine just for me to work on a novel. It was fantastic. Some people find it that you're there with other artists from other genres. I found that generative. Some people find those people can be difficult sometimes. If the interpersonal stuff is a source of tension and stress, it can really ruin it. But I never had that experience. I loved all four of the places that I visited.
And what was the one in New York Mills like?
New York Mills, in New York Mills, Minnesota. It was great. I was the only person there at New York Mills. That's how they set that up. I had a whole house to myself for the month. I had everything I needed. I had support from the people at the arts center there. You know, a bike to ride around. I mean, it was great. It was wonderful. That, again, is not necessarily for everyone, because it's only you and you're there to work, so there's not the camaraderie of the other artists. But I found that space wonderful as well.
That's Scott Muskin. We're talking about The Annunciations of Hank Meyerson, Mama's Boy and Scholar. There's lots of information at Scott's website, scottmuskin.com, including these really cool videos you did of how to find your book. Tell us about those.
Some people might not find them cool, but I appreciate that you labeled them that way. I liked them. I just decided, you know, you put a book out there and it's with a small press, and you can take one of, you know, several approaches. You could say, well, I know it's a great book, and I'm just gonna let the world find it, and you know, let whatever happens happens, and let the press do everything. Or you can take the attitude that, well, what am I going to do to try to find this book a larger audience? And now that I have a baby and writing, you know, I'm not necessarily able to write as much or as intensely as I used to. I hope that changes sometime soon, and I am working on another novel. But working on these videos was just an easy way to get some creativity into my life, and I could cart the baby around with me and then work on the, you know, the editing late at night and get some creativity and have some fun, and also maybe try to create some buzz for the book. Because honestly, it's a very crowded market of all types of cool things out there for people vying for people's attention, and legitimately so. And if you don't sort of help your book get noticed, I personally believe at least you're doing a disservice and to yourself and to your work.
I like how your baby shows up in the videos, too.
Me, too. It's definitely gratuitous. Gratuitous baby shot is what I call it.
Well, I have posted a link to those on the Real Good Words blog, so folks can take a look at it there. Well, Scott, I hope we can talk to you for your next novel as well, and it's been great talking to you. Thanks.
I hope so, too, and it's been a real pleasure for me as well. I appreciate it very much.